Greetings, fellow Constant Readers. You are listening to, or perhaps you're watching, the Company of the Mad, the Stand podcast. And we are back. It has been a bit of a hiatus, but we are back, and I cannot wait to discuss chapters 50 through 55 of Stephen King's The Stand with my distinguished panel today. If you are listening, you can let us know your thoughts by using hashtag The Stand Challenge. You can also watch the video of this podcast at thestandpodcast.com. We are so lucky to have, I feel so lucky to be able to talk about this book. At one point it was every month, now it's every few months. But I feel so lucky to be able to talk about this book with such intelligent and incredible people. Mike Flanagan is with us. Mike, I am binge watching The Haunting of Bly Manor, and holy heck, I don't want to ruin anything for any listeners. I don't want to like let them in on anything, but I will say that I am really glad that I made the executive decision the night before Bly Manor dropped on Netflix to watch a little film from 1961 called The Innocents.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I mean, besides being based on the same story, obviously, was there any watching of The Innocents before going into this production? And
it was the first thing we did as a writer's room. Wow. We did the same thing on Hill House. Our day one, we went over to Amblin, and Spielberg let us use his theater to watch The Haunting. And so for this one, we did The Innocents on day one as our way to kind of kick it all off. And that movie, it's so, so masterful, that film. It's one of those reasons, you look at those movies and it makes it really clear why it's pointless to try to do a straight adaptation of the source material, because they already did it perfectly, and it's just kind of like, well.
No. Yeah. You're doing it beyond perfectly. And I have to say that there are moments even where the cinematographer, I feel like there's, or maybe it's your choice as a director, I don't know, especially in the first episode, there are shots where, it's hard for me to describe because I'm not a director or a film person, but it's like, there's like something close up in the foreground and then something sort of far away, it seems, in the background. And it's almost like I kept wanting to watch that episode in black and white to see like how much it would look like The Innocents. And
I don't know where you are in the series, but be careful what you wish for in that regard. Yeah.
Really? Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I guess I kind of know where you are then.
No way. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Oh, that's so cool. Yeah. That's so cool.
But look, I thanks for watching it, and thank you for watching Jack Clayton's movie, because I think that film's getting a nice little a nice little boost right now, and it deserves it so much. It's one of the most influential horror movies ever made, and we went out of our way to try to quote that movie with as much love and reverence as we could, because it's, you know, still stands up as one of the scariest films I've ever seen, ever.
Even your lead character's name is a tribute, isn't it?
It is Danny Clayton.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I wondered the name, one of the names seems almost a combination of a name of the actors from the first one too. Wingrave, is that it?
Wingrave we actually took from another Henry James story.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which was Owen Wingrave, another one of his ghost stories. So we've been mixing and matching from a bunch of sources for it.
That's incredible.
I'm thrilled you're enjoying it.
And I'm sure that The Innocents is getting a boost right now. You know, something else that's getting a boost right now. I've noticed, by the way, welcome Tananarive Due. Tananarive Due is a novelist and the producer of Shudder's Horror Noir, A History of Black Horror. But I realize that you don't need to have a subscription to Shudder right now to watch horror noir. All you need is Amazon Prime. So I'm guessing that is sort of going through the roof right now with ratings too. Have you had a lot of people reach out to you about it?
It's a great second life, you know. Horror noir came out in February, January of 2019. So It's been a while, but more and more people are finding it. People found it through the summer, when there were a lot of questions about Black Lives Matter and finding, you know, other voices in horror. So they got very curious. And then Amazon Prime, bam, it's like coming out for the first time.
Wow. Wow, that's so cool. I bet you're getting a lot of people who are, because it keeps popping up in my, because I watch Amazon Prime almost every night. And it just keeps popping up. I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm like, that's so amazing. I know who did that. I'm like, I know.
Well, I was just really, really lucky to be invited to be an executive producer. That's how I feel about it. I was teaching Black horror, and I've been a Black horror creator since 1995, but there's never been a renaissance like this, anything close to it right now, in terms of the interest in my work, in terms of Lovecraft Country and Jordan Peele. So there's a lot of curiosity about this subgenre. And the thing I love about horror fans is that deep down, we just want to be scared, right? And novel is scary. So if it's a slightly different mythology, if it's a slightly different twist, if it's more of a social justice, racism as the monster angle, it's something you haven't seen exactly a million times before. Horror fans really respond to that. And even horror noir, which points out like tropes and issues, you know, which we've discussed in this podcast, like the magical Negro and the sacrificial Negro and all that. Even so, I find most horror audiences are just like, oh my God, I learned so much. I can't wait to check out these old movies like Ganja and Hess and Tales from the Hood, even, you know, Blackula. So the audience has just been super receptive. It's just exciting.
Oh, that's amazing. That's amazing. And of course, our listeners can take your online download course, The Sunken Place, by going to TananaReevedu.com. We have Anthony Bresnikan with us. Anthony Bresnikan is a novelist and the Los Angeles correspondent for Vanity Fair. Bresnikan, you hosted your own panel at the virtual New York Comic Con interviewing the cast of the new CBS television series adaptation of The Stand. How cool is that?
It was a lot of fun. It was great to have that whole cast together and pick their brains a little about what it was like to shoot, especially since they were wrapping up the production as the pandemic was hitting. And you know, Greg Kinnear, who plays Glenn Bateman on the series, was like, he was obsessively tracking this information, and everybody treated him like he was a loon until it really started to take off. And then he was like, people were a little freaked out, like coming to his trailer. Like, he developed quite a following as things were really unfolding. But it'll be neat to see that show. I can't wait. You guys all saw the trailer, I'm presuming, that they debuted there. Looks pretty good.
I think I watched it 5 times in a row when it launched, just studying it. For every frame, it's really exciting.
I love that floor, that carpet.
Yes, so yeah, the overlook carpet's in there. That was really great. That made me so happy.
What did you think of the trailer, Tanana Reeve?
I am just realizing, how did I miss this trailer?
Oh, shoot. Well, listen.
I'm going to watch it immediately after this. Shame on me.
If anyone else is in the same position as you are, then they can go to thestandpodcast.com, where you can watch Anthony's interview with the entire cast. We've got it all queued up and waiting for you over there. And right after the interviews with the cast, they debut the trailer. So you can watch that and then enjoy the trailer right afterwards.
Where have I been? What is wrong with me? But anyway, I'm back to reality now. That's all that matters. The things that are important.
Exactly. These are the things that are important. The standards.
Yes.
These are the things that are important. I, of course, am your host, Jason Seacrest. I write scary stuff, and I write about scary stuff, too. I'm an author of horror fiction, and I write a column for Stephen King's limited edition publishers called What I Learned from Stephen King, exploring the wisdom, life lessons, and spirituality in King's many works. You can hear me read those columns to you, read all my horror fiction, and get bonus podcast episodes where I ramble on for hours when you subscribe at patreon.com/Jason Seacrest. You can find a link to this and also to Tanana Reevedu's online course, all these things and more, at thestandpodcast.com. We are also joined today by a very, very special guest. I have to tell you, I've been wanting to have this guy on the podcast from the beginning, because his book really has proven to be a huge resource for me as the host of this podcast. Andy Burns is the author of This Dark Chest of Wonders, 40 Years of Stephen King's The Stand, which was published by Cemetery Dance Publications. You can get it at cemeterydance.com. Andy has also the distinction of having interviewed the cast of the upcoming series, quite in depth, in fact, for his forthcoming book, The Making of the Stand for CBS All Access. Andy, welcome to the show.
Oh, well, thanks. Thanks. It's super cool to be here with everyone. And quite honestly, over the past 6 months, everyone's writing here and has helped get me through the pandemic. In the case of Mike, he has absolutely made one of my favorite all-time films with Dr. Sleep. So the fact that I'm staring across from everyone here right now, talking about Stephen King, talking about The Stand, it's really my honor. So thank you for thanks to everyone for having me. It's really a privilege.
Andy, I want to ask you, but it's the same first question that I ask of all my prey on this show. How did you come to love Stephen King? How did you first come to love Stephen King? And when did you first read The Stand?
Okay, so first, the answer to the first question is probably around 1984, 85. I was 8 years old. I was on vacation with my mom in West Palm Beach, Florida, visiting my bubby, my grandmother, at her condo complex. There was a swimming pool and there was like a little, you know, cabana sort of where there were books where you could go in and people would leave books. And there was a copy of the movie tie-in version of Christine. And I remember it because it had pictures in it, which is, you know, that's what it was like back in the 80s. You would have pictures and tie-ins and everything. So I didn't read the book. I just looked at the pictures constantly. When I got back from Florida, I was visiting my dad, who had a pretty good library, and he had just the paperback version of Christine. And so I swiped it from him, and I read it, and I was too young. Probably, I mean, but I think I've turned out okay. But that set me on the path of reading King. And, you know, it was such a different time back in the 80s growing up where, you know, I would go, my dad and I would go to movies on Sundays. And so we would go see movies like Cat's Eye. And when the trade paperback edition of The Dark Tower came out, you know, it was no problem for my parent to buy me a copy of that. So I was into King at a very young age. Probably my worst experience reading him was having the chicken pox at age 10 and my mother buying me Night Shift and me reading The Boogeyman, which has stuck with me as I'm 43 years old. And I've only been able to close closets probably in the past 3 years. That's how I got into King. It's all true. Like, this is no exaggeration. God bless him. But I mean, he's had a significant effect on my life.
And your psyche.
All of it has been great. But then when it comes to The Stand, the uncut version was released in 1990. And I write about it in this Dark Chest of Wonders. I was 13 in 1990 and I was having my bar mitzvah. And, you know, at a bar mitzvah, you get all sorts of presents and everything. And I don't really remember most of the presents that I got. I call myself an apathetic Jew. It was just something that I had to go through to make my mom happy. And the present that I remember the most came from these family friends that you call uncle and aunt. And what they gave me was The Stand uncut. And I remember it. And it really, you know, I was 13. I'd read some big books. I was reading big books when I was pretty young. But that book in particular, when you think about it, like 13 years old, like, I wasn't schlepping it, you know, to school every day, or I wasn't, you know, when I would go see my dad, I wasn't taking it on trips. I would, every night after school, I would go onto these brown couches that were in my mom's place. I remember it vividly. And I would sit down and I would just dive right into it. And I think it probably took me maybe 3 months to read it. And it was just after that, that it just stuck with me. And sometimes I don't know the why, because I've read most of King's work. I think it was the epic nature of it. I think it was the characters, but it was really, you know, it never went away from me, even as I got older and I started reading, you know, as I started sort of diving into lit, you know, English lit and like discovering all sorts of other writers. That book was always, if I did my like top five books of all time, The Stand was always on that list. Yeah, it was always cool. on it. It's still on it. So, you know, those are my sort of earliest experiences with King, then leading into reading The Stand.
Wow, that's amazing. Have you reread it at all during the pandemic?
Only with the idea of us, you know, and listening to you guys. I kind of go between, I have a couple different, you know, there's been so many different ways to absorb The Stand. So I've been reading chapters here and there, listening to you guys, but I've also been going into the comic book because I love the comic book. Mm. That's actually my kind of go-to in terms of when I want my Stand fix. You know, and part of it is because it's just a little bit more digestible. You know, I've got it in like the big Marvel omnibus, but I've also got it on my Comixology, so I can dive in here and there. Yeah, I mean, I've been looking at it and, you know, and I was thinking about it, knowing that I was going to be talking to everyone today and thinking about, you know, what do you say about The Stand, especially in a time like this? And one of the things that I think about is just the foresight, in a way, that King had about the world that we're currently living in right now. And even though, you know, the effect, you know, Captain Trips is not the same as COVID in terms of how, you know, the mortality rate and everything. But I think that the way that people are dealing with the world and in the political situation right now, and all these things that we're dealing with right now, it's all in there.
It's super relevant. Yeah.
It really is.
More relevant maybe than ever. It's really something. It's really amazing.
Yeah. It's you know, you wonder why it sort of, you know, makes, you know, the list of the greatest books or everything. And it's like, well, this is why, because it's right. I mean, unfortunately, in some ways, it's right now.
Listen, I know that you were on the set of the new television series for CBS All Access a lot, and you were interviewing several of the cast members, if not all of the cast members, and producers and showrunners and all of that. What can you tell us about this show?
Not much. Nothing. I can't really tell you much. here, you know.
Are we going to be happy?
Here's what I think I can say. So I was invited when Josh Boone was directing the first and the final episodes. He read The Dark Chest of Wonders. He invited me to the set. There was an idea going around that he was hoping that maybe I'd be able to do something like The Making of The Stand, you know, sort of a nice hardcover book. CBS was very into that idea, thankfully. Benjamin Cavell and Taylor Elmore were super supportive. So I spent a couple days on set early on into filming. And as a guy that had never been on set before, I really walked away with a newfound appreciation for all the hard work that goes into creating a film and creating TV. It was that was a revelation to me. What I've seen of the show, I think people are going to be very happy. You know, Anthony said it, he wrote about it in his Vanity Fair article. You know, there are some changes, like in terms of when the show starts. To me, everything works. Here's the one thing that I feel like I can say, I can feel very comfortable saying. Everybody that I talked to, specifically the actors, talked about the openness of collaboration that they felt in working with all the creatives. That was a common refrain for everyone that I spoke with. Wow. And down to the person. And I think that will make for something really special. When all these people are, I mean, there's a love of King, there's a love of the work. It just, that to me was really inspiring. And having seen some of these actors work, I mean, you have veterans that are part of this series. And, you know, part of them being veterans is the fact that, you know, they're going to deliver great work. What I think is going to blow people's minds is some of the younger actors who are involved in the work that they do. I think people are going to just really think it's spectacular. Yeah, I feel like that's all I can say. I don't want to get in trouble.
I understand. I understand. I know I was going to ask, I was going to say, you know, I know you can't, I know you can't say whether or not you have seen like the first episodes or anything like that. So I'll just ask, like, you know, how are they? No, I'm kidding. You know, it's okay. It's okay. We're not going to make you say anything that's going to get you in trouble.
I am very optimistic. How about that?
That's amazing. I'm
extremely optimistic.
That's great. All right, so let's dive into the book a little bit. We're talking in this episode about chapters 50 to 55, and these are the first pages in which, at long last, so many of the characters get to finally meet each other. And man, does that provide for some really entertaining reading, because the stand is so long that it's almost like these, you know, mini tribes that have been traveling together. It's like, this was a novel and that was a novel. And it's like, what if the characters from two of your favorite novels got to meet each other? That's what it feels like when Larry Underwood meets Franny to me. Like, that's one of my favorite sequences. And the whole idea of Larry's point of view, how Larry views Harold, and how Franny suddenly feels guilty about the way that she views him. I really love getting to see these characters start to finally interact with each other. How did you feel, Anthony?
Same thing. It's kind of funny that Larry, we already have our opinion of Harold, and Larry shows up with a bottle of 1947 wine and some chocolate paydays that only exist in the Stand Plague universe. Although I think they've created them now. So, yeah, he shows up admiring him because he painted on the wall where they were going, and he credits him with helping, their little group make their way to Boulder. That chocolate payday thing is really funny. Years ago, ironically, when the Dr. Sleep novel came out, I interviewed King, and we were talking about, he had a guy who would reread his old books and give him notes on like things that were connected. So he would, this guy would help him with the Dark Tower series. He had him reread The Shining so that when he read Dr. Sleep, he could say, here's what you got wrong, or here's what doesn't match up. And because he said he doesn't have a mind for that sort of thing. Like, he'll, obviously he wrote the book, but he's not going to remember all those little details. But he said, you know, he's like, no matter how hard you try, you always mess up a little bit. He goes, you know, I had that chocolate thumbprint from Harold on the diaries, and that's how Franny knows that he was reading her diaries and knows she doesn't think very much of him. He goes, but then I would get letter after letter saying, payday doesn't make a chocolate candy bar. It's just nuts and nougat. So you're wrong. And I was like, that's, in that level of reality, that's the difference between the Plague universe and the one that we live in that survived, was there were there were chocolate paydays in that one.
Amazing. That's great. But
it's a funny little detail. I love it because they just kept mentioning that thumbprint and the paydays that Larry comes to give to him. Like, so I kept thinking of that quote from him.
That is so funny. That is so funny. Were there any characters that you were really interested in reading their first meeting to Nana Reeve?
Well, yeah, back to this scene. I hate to echo what Anthony said, but the meeting with Larry and Harold, it just goes to show how we can't put celebrities we don't know on a pedestal, I think, because his image of who Harold is, and yes, he did risk himself to paint those signs, and part of that was altruism, and part of that was, of course, you're trying to find tribe, you know, you're some of the last survivors, no one wants to be alone, we're herd creatures. But the Harold Larry went to meet is not the Harold we know, so I was kind of hoping that everyone who met Harold would just feel his burgeoning evil baking off of him. And it was very frustrating when they didn't see it right away, although Stu got a vibe. Stu got a vibe from Harold that
the start, yeah.
And Leo.
Yeah.
And Leo.
which I thought was awesome. It's like, yes, more of that. But that meeting was an interesting one. And just to see, as you said, everyone finally becoming a unit, coalescing, building community, to gain strength from each other, that all of that was really, really exciting. And of course, love to see Franny happy, you know, together with Stu.
I also love the it's more of a confrontation than a meeting, but the first time that that Nadine meets Mother Abigail. It's just, hi, I'm Nadine Grubb. She goes, I know who you are. It's just like, it's like, whoa. It's like, whoa, my God. Like, I just read that and I was like, damn. I'm like, she just like read her. Like, I know who you are. I loved that. I loved that. Really, Mother Abigail's meeting with everyone is so... you just want to, I just want to wrap myself up in a blanket and just read those sections over and over and over again. I loved it. We've also got the disappearance of Mother Abigail in these chapters. And let's talk a little bit about what Mother Abigail calls the mother of all sins, pride. Mm. I don't know about you, but I feel like Abby's being a little hard on herself here. Anyone, like, when you're reading this, are you thinking, like, come on, like, you're fine, like, you're good, like, you're all good, like, it's really interesting. And I tell you what, I'll go here with it, because I didn't know if I was going to bring this up or not, but I can play a little devil's advocate here, in that as somebody who really links Stephen King to spirituality, these pages in particular, these five chapters for me, have more spirituality in them and more lessons that we can glean and learn than maybe any other place in the novel so far, at least for me. It will take a lot for me to not actually just consume all of our time with that. But I will say that when it comes to the disappearance of Mother Abigail, it makes me wonder, what is the message here for us? What are we supposed to take from it? That the leader of the pack, that the tribe that is the side of good, that she abandons them for some kind of late life walkabout to grapple with the issue of pride. And I suppose that one lesson that we can learn from that, or maybe what we're supposed to take from it at the end of the day, is that the best of spiritual leaders, to be a spiritual leader, is not to tell someone what to do spiritually, but to work on your own self spiritually and lead by example. I know that there's many, many highly religious people who will tell you that the only real relationship that matters is your relationship with God. But like I said, to play devil's advocate, in the middle of a pandemic that has killed 99.9% of the population, I don't know that one's spiritual purpose is to go off by themselves, but to take care of each other. It's a tough decision. I tend to believe, even not in a pandemic, that spirituality is not meditating alone on the mountain, but being amongst the people, caring for people, loving for people, sharing with people, leading by example, and guiding others when they ask for your guidance. So it brings me to this devil's advocate of a question, which is Mother Abigail flawed as a spiritual leader? I'd love to get your take on how you felt about her decision to leave the group and what you think it means that we're supposed to glean from that. Mike?
I mean, first of all, that's a great question. I think I come at it from a bit of a different perspective, because while I completely agree with you that these chapters are imbued with enormous spirituality, and I think it's just as much worth talking about God's Tom as it is talking about, you know, what happens with Mother
Abigail.
Absolutely.
Because that's
a really
absolutely
fascinating thing happening.
The divinity.
I'm an atheist. And so I go through and process these kind of story points very differently. And I kind of connected with, you know, the judge even says when, you know, Larry asks, do you think she's alive? Do you think she's dead? Where could she be? And the judge even says, you know, well, she took off, I think, because of religious mania. Which is a really fascinating choice of words there.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I viewed it. I tend to feel the same way, that, you know, the responsibility to the group should supersede kind of a crisis of identity, which is, I think, is what she's kind of going through. However, the point that even the best people and the most needed leaders are susceptible to the corrosive effects of pride, I think is a wonderful thing to point out. And I think the strength of her character to remove herself from a position where she could inadvertently do damage to this growing fledgling society, until she could confirm for herself that her intentions were pure, I think that's really a powerful thing. I think that's a very powerful message.
Amazing.
If I lived in Boulder at the time, I'd be like, get back here. But, you know, yeah. being able to kind of look at the plan that seems to be existing underneath all of this in King's mind, God's plan, that really, I think, the mask comes down on that when they hypnotize Tom and you meet this other character.
Yeah, totally.
One of my favorite scenes of this stretch. You know, I in that respect, I think it's not for us to understand what is happening between Mother Abigail and God in this. I think, you know, she should know best. And what I love about the story in general is that so often what you think is the plan or the point or the way it's going to go isn't. And even this, you know, the stand of the title that we're all expecting, the battle, you know, is so not a battle the way you think it's going to be ultimately. All of this has a very humble Christianity kind of pulsing behind it. And I think in the way that her journey, you know, has echoes of the gospel story, that Jesus did the same thing and had to kind of check himself and get out of there for a minute. You know, I appreciate all of that. Just the way King is kind of playing with the mechanics and the engine of Christianity in order to kind of tell a story of a leader who has found humility, tethered with great responsibility and power. I think that's a wonderful thing.
That's amazing. That's very well said. Very, very well said. Anyone else want to weigh in on their thoughts on Mother Abigail sort of exiting the tribe here?
Yeah, can I jump in on this? Because I find this fascinating. I mean, others of you sort of with a more encyclopedic knowledge of everything King has written might know better, but he does not, in my memory, write about God and Christianity in particular in a very positive way. I keep thinking about Carrie, you know, as the contrast to this, when you talk about the fanaticism of Carrie's mother and how damaging that was. And for the most part, when King's characters get in trouble, the first thing they're doing is not getting down on their knees and praying. You know, there's just not a whole lot of prayer in Christianity. So it really kind of jumps out in these sections, and the creation of Mother Abigail as this charismatic leader who seems to have a genuine pipeline to God. And as Mike pointed out, all of this is confirmed through God's Tom under the hypnosis scene. So it's like God is real in this story. I think it's pretty undeniably, which is fascinating to me. And these sections and Mother Gail's disappearance, yes, it's about humility. Yes, there must be so much pressure on her not to be taking sort of a personal pride and feeling of responsibility. But these chapters also read like the separation of church and state part of the novel to me, because whether it's the committee members who were nervous about what kind of role she might have in terms of the government, like you're trying to create a government, and then Mother Abigail says, you know what though, I don't think anyone should be able to vote. Not that she would, but she could, you know, if they gave her sort of a state position. And Mother Abigail herself clearly wants to separate from that organization aspect of the town and not try to put too much of her hand on that. So I find that very interesting. And I can't help wonder, as the artist, there's what it means in the story, and there's what it means as the actual author and his reasons. And I'm very curious about that long disappearance for Mother Abigail. Was it that her, from an artistic level, is her job done? And that's why she's able to disappear from the story in terms of sort of the creation aspect of that. But inside Mother Abigail's head, yes, I can totally believe what a mind trip that would be, that everyone's looking at you as sort of this appendage of God. And the weight of that would be very frightening.
I think King gives us a clue to what he's thinking, and it's exactly what you said. And it comes right before our assigned reading, so we may have forgotten it from last time. But in chapter 49, the judge is talking about Larry. Who's he talking to? He's talking with Lucy, right? And he says, Larry is a man who found himself comparatively late in life. Now, Mother Abigail, I would say, she's very self-possessed and has been for a long time, but at least as a leader, she's coming to it very late. 108 years old is pretty late in the game. But he goes, and it's funny because he uses men, so I think it's disguised a little bit, but I think this applies to anybody. He says, men who find themselves late are never sure. They are all the things the civics books tell us good citizens should be. Partisans, but never zealots. Respecters of the facts which attend each situation, but never benders of those facts. Uncomfortable in positions of leadership, but rarely able to turn down a responsibility once it has been offered or thrust upon them. They make the best leaders in a democracy because they are unlikely to fall in love with power. And I think that's Mother Abigail. Is she, you know, note when she disappears is right when the mass of people come to her, right? So they're reaching the point where there's a lot of discussion about how many people are left out there and how many people may be coming. She disappears at the exact moment they're forming their little ad hoc committees and restarting their government, just as you say. So she's not the dictator of the good people. She removes herself from that equation, and they have to have all these meetings and make all these decisions on their own, and they make them together rather than turning to her for, you know, God's point of view. That's not what the God of this story wants. And you're absolutely right. Usually King has a very cynical view of religion. I think of Mrs. Carmody from The Mist. You remember, she becomes like the demagogue of the grocery store. But I think that's a clue. I think he's left that little thing for here's why she's leaving. That's the pride. I think she's just hypersensitive to the idea of not wanting to become the Lord Almighty of the Boulder Free Zone. She's gonna remove herself and let them sort it out. That they're in. It's like letting your kids walk and play a little bit without hovering over them.
I've always seen it as, you know, I think I've never thought of King as having a negative or a cynical point of view on religion as much as it is a point of view on zealotry. I think
well, hypocrisy too. I
think. Yes, and it just hypocrisy in general, absolutely.
Which is a good bullshit detector.
I mean, if only more religious leaders, you know, did this at that sort of the height of their swell of success. I was like, let me take a step back.
Very
and
true.
Meditate within myself, and you know, because power corrupts, and we see that over and over and over again. And Mother Abigail does not want to be corrupted by her power.
Very true.
Hey, did you guys catch the weird little cameo that was in the book too?
Who?
Stephen King puts his own father into the story in that sequence where Mother Abigail is recalling in the 30s, a salesman comes to her door and his name is Don King. That's his father's name.
No way!
Wow, I completely missed that. Yeah. Wow.
Front door. I have no idea.
Yeah, he comes and he's a little bit like a grifter type. He's trying to sell her a vacuum cleaner. Now, what's interesting is his father wouldn't have been old enough for this to actually be his father in 1931. But like, he gives him his father's name. He gives him his, I think his father's profession was that he was a salesman. And as you guys probably know, his father abandoned the family when Stephen was like a baby. And the line, I saved it here. She said, you know, Mother Abigail is saying if she doesn't have money for that vacuum cleaner, she doesn't even have money for ribbons. This is the Depression. And she goes, but say, didn't that Mr. Donald King of Peru, Indiana, talk sweet? My, she had never seen him again, but she had never forgotten his name either. She just bet he had gone on to break some white lady's heart.
Wow.
Wow.
Now he's like throwing some ice at his old man. And what's funny is Stephen did this, you know, those, like, I forget what it's called, but Henry Louis Gates hosts those, like, those specials on PBS
about
Ancestry. Yeah. He did one of those with Gates, and Gates provided him this book all about his father, that stuff he never knew. He didn't even know what he looked like. He didn't have any pictures of him. And it turns out his name isn't Don King. It was Don Pollock. So Stephen's real name would be Stephen Pollock. Huh. But it, you know, his father changed it for some reason before he married his mother and had his kids. But it's just wild to me that he puts his dad in the book in that one moment.
Wow.
That's incredible. Close read.
I mean,
for you. Wow.
I mean, yeah, you guys are blowing my mind this episode, I have to say. I mean, between that, the find of King's father, and also Tanana Reeve, your whole idea of the separation of church and state. I had not even considered that. That's so brilliant. That's such an amazing take on that. And you know, it is in those chapters that there's all of this talk about the Free Zone Committee. It's all the notes from the Free Zone Committee meetings. And it is interesting that they kind of start out thinking that they're going to, it almost seems like they have a feeling like they're going to reinvent the country a bit. But what's funny is they keep coming back to old America and kind of creating the same thing, a republic. And
Glenn,
yeah. And Glenn Bateman sees it right away, that this is really the only way. And eventually the others follow suit. And in this way, I feel like The Stand becomes a love letter to America, to this complicated and complex system that's the foundation that makes this republic run in the way that it does. Did anyone else feel King's just love of America just sort of coming out of these chapters?
I didn't feel the love so much because he describes them as a toy box that's blown up. And some of those toys should be thrown away. So I think he was like, you know, let's build it. I mean, to use a phrase now that Joe Biden is using, build back better. Like, let's get rid of some of the things that were bad about the society.
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely correct.
And
yeah.
I'm a big, big fan of the Constitution, for the record. But, you know, there's a couple little things you might want to just edit before you ratify that again. You know.
It's a first draft that came up a bit wanting, it turns out, and we've for whatever reason just kind of let it live. But I think what struck me about this as well, and we talked about this in some of the previous chapters, is that as you get to this beautiful stretch of the book where a lot of the supernatural action slows down and it really is about talking about government and how to rebuild, I had the same feeling I had early on, where when this was written, The Stand is the parable, right? Like, The Stand is supposed to be the exaggerated, extreme version of reality to help us kind of learn lessons about the world we live in. And once, yet again, I felt like the parable is tamer than the reality, as I was jealous of them putting together this government without an active chaos agent out there. Or like when they were like, well, who's going to go to Flag's side? And he said, well, I bet he's going to get a lot of the techies. Mm-hmm. And I was like, first of all, hey. And second of all, no, it would be split on party lines. Like, they don't have to deal with the fact that, you know, Vegas would be all over Fox News as like the place to be where the lights are on. And even down to Harold, where it was like, okay, yes, Harold sucks and he's really evil and I hate him a ton, but he doesn't hold a candle to, you know, violent radicalized incels right now, or QAnon, or, you know, like that there was a sense with all of this that everything was a little naive is the wrong word, because I do not think it's naive. I think, and for the time it was written, it was exactly right. I just feel like I again found myself envious of this fictional world that for most of my life felt more exaggerated and more far flung than reality, and right now feels like, you know, slightly better. Like the only difference is the body count. It's really rough.
And that's so sobering. And sorry, Jason, but just to follow up really quickly on what Mike said, I think that speaks to your original question about the love baking through, because for all the editing maybe that could have been done, it was so orderly and it was so peaceful. And there are real chaos agents present, like huge ones, but their behavior was so much more civilized, back to Mike's point. So you can almost hear sort of the violin swells as we get to those meetings and everyone's coming together. And the last thing I'll say about that is only Stephen King could get me to read meeting minutes in a novel.
I couldn't agree more.
I get we have to rebuild society, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. But even so, I could just see myself in the meeting going, oh my God, is this over yet? Because I hate meetings so much.
So funny, I had the same thought when I was reading it. It's just hysterical. Andy, you have done so much research on this. Do you know in any way like what King was going for in terms of a love letter to America or things about America that he might have wanted changed at the time that he was writing it?
No, you know, I can't speak specifically to that, but I do know that in these chapters, we're sort of entering the stage of the book where it is a lot of meeting notes. And it is a lot of minutiae in terms of forming the government. And I think that at a certain point that was weighing on King as he was writing it, because, you know, and I can't remember the direct quote, but I think at a certain point in time, he realized, well, what do you do to sort of get things going again? And it's, well, you blow something up, which eventually happens with Mother Abigail's place. But it's interesting because for me anyway, and maybe it's the Canadian in me, I don't know, but as I was reading this sort of aspirational sort of let's kind of get back to normal, which, you know, relating to the world that we live in right now, I don't know if I've, you know, just with age I've become more cynical, or that the idea of normal when I'm watching everyone, you know, we're gonna have our meeting and we're gonna set things up this way, I'm just kind of like, well, you know, normal we're living in a new normal, just like everybody in Boulder was kind of living in. I felt like they missed the fact that I feel like a lot of people are missing right now in life, is that normal's gone. You know, whatever comes next, like whatever tomorrow brings is the new normal. And I think that you sort of get that throughout the novel too, that there's this, let's kind of get back to how we were. And I'm like, I just, as I was rereading it this time, if, you know, and Mike, I know you said naive isn't the right word, but to me, when it kind of felt that way, because how do you get back to normal when 99% of the world is gone? And I end up relating it to the world that we live in now. It's like, how do we get back to normal? And that's, you know, that's part of the timeliness, I think, of The Stand, in some ways, the unfortunate timeliness of it. But how do we get back to normal? And it's like, I don't think, you know, I don't think anybody should plan on getting back to normal. I don't think the guys in Boulder should plan on getting back to normal. I think they should be looking to a new normal. And yeah, it's interesting because, you know, knowing that everyone here was reading these chapters and going back and rereading them, and, you know, you read them now in a different light. But the irony for me is that this section has my favorite scene in the entire Stand, these chapters 50 to 55. And I'm probably the only one that finds it their favorite chapter or their favorite scene, but it stuck with me since I was 13, and it's Stu talking about meeting Jim Morrison. And that was like, I had no idea as I was doing my reread that it fell into this place. But, you know, so we're going through all of these, like, the minutiae of getting back to life, and then you have this really surreal moment in there that for me it was a funny juxtaposition.
Great. I wanted to read something here. In terms of The Stand's take on America, I thought this was an interesting opinion. I spoke recently with Mick Garris, who directed the 1990s miniseries adaptation of The Stand for television. I was interviewing him actually for a column that I write for Suntup Editions. They make, by the way, I just have to say, they make the most beautiful, like, gorgeously crafted. I know Mike's not, and Mike's a huge fan of theirs. They make the most they just make the most beautiful, gorgeously crafted books that you've ever seen in your life. Really, you should go to suntup.press, look them up, check them out. They're great. But I write a column for them, and I was interviewing Mick for this column, and I asked him what he believes. As the director of the miniseries, I said, obviously you're a huge fan of the novel. What do you really think that The Stand is about? What is The Stand about to you? And I wanted to make sure that I quoted him exactly to get it right. So hang on here. He said, the real theme of The Stand for me was being able to become a patriot again and not let the country go to the rabid right wing, but to start a society over the way we intended it. The way the Founding Fathers intended it, based on freedom and equality. The visual moment that is the most important to me in The Stand is when Gary Sinise just breaks out of the medical facility. Everyone else in it is dead, and he jumps over the wall, lands on the grass, looks up, and there's the American flag waving overhead. That's not something that was in the book, but it meant something to me as someone who cares about the planet, about the country, about administrations, and the ideal of America. What it was founded upon has been so raked over and plundered and destroyed in so many ways by financial interests and personal interest and rabid racism and things like that. The idea of being able to reboot and start over again with what the dream of America was meant to be is what the stand is about, to be able to reclaim patriotism. I thought that was a great quote. I thought it
McGarris.
Yeah, I thought it deserved its place in the breadth of this podcast somewhere to have that in here, because I just thought it's very well said from someone who clearly knows the source material very, very well.
Great quote.
There's also a lot of discussion in these chapters, obviously, about who to send to spy on Flag's camp. So I want to ask, it's a sort of a double-sided question, who would you have sent, and would you have volunteered yourself to go? Let's start with Andy.
would I have volunteered to go? I doubt it, to be honest with you. I mean, I'm not gonna put any false bravery on here.
Honesty's the best policy here. Honesty's the best policy.
It's a great question, and I've always thought that those choices and the logic behind the choices of those three characters made a lot of sense. Especially with Tom. I mean, King takes his time getting, taking us through Tom and, from the debate as to whether he should be going through to the setup of him actually, being hypnotized and everything. That's an excellent question. I wish I wouldn't have to go first. But it's hard for me. It's really actually hard for me to think of anybody else that of everyone. Because everyone has their role in that book, and all the roles make a lot of sense, and all those characters are so crafted. It's kind of hard to see anybody outside of how they've been cast. It's perfect casting. Yeah, that's my answer. But yeah, I'm not going.
You're not going, Anthony.
I would go, but I have a bad poker face and I would be caught immediately. So, I like that they sent Tom. I like it because he has a real role to play, and there's some language in the discussion about him where they use the word retarded, which is not a word we would use today. And it was funny because it was jarring for me to see it. But the context in which the characters were using it, it didn't read like an insult. It read more like just an un-PC term for disabled, right? That they weren't calling him this name. It was more a term for being cognitively disabled, which 30 years ago when he rewrote the book and 40 some years ago when he wrote the original novel just wasn't a part of the consideration. But that aside, they love Tom. Right, they care about him and they don't want to send him into harm's way, but they also gather that he has value, that he's an important part of their community, and he could be an important part of this struggle that they have. So I like that they entrust it with him and they do a little hypnosis, and I think that's more for the readers and for their benefit to get this sense of some otherworldly connection that's pulling a few strings. But the one thing that I would have been hesitant to do is, what I like is that the Boulder Free Zone welcomes people like Tom and sees value in them. I'm not sure that the folks in Vegas have that same respect or interest in being united and helping those in need, whatever that need may be. I think that's the definition of a good society, is when we look around and we say, okay, who's struggling? Who's not in the boat? And we pull them into the boat. I don't know that the Vegas would have had the same perspective. And I can't remember what happens to him once he gets there, but I think they kind of just give him some menial tasks, like they kind of tolerate him, but not.
No spoilers.
It's not a spoiler because I haven't read it in 30 years, so I can't remember, but I don't think they really like take care of him, but you're putting him at risk. But also, he's got a part to play. He's something beyond just the funny guy who, you know, spells MOON. They give him heart, and they give him a task, and they trust him, and he cares about them too. I think it's really nice. I can't think of who else to send, but I might send Franny because she's sharp, you know. But she's pregnant too, so you gotta protect her. But I think a kick-ass pregnant lady taking on the devil is not a bad not a bad plot twist, right?
Not bad at all. Tanana Reeve?
So, big scaredy cat here. I think if someone were holding my family at gunpoint and said, you have to go, okay, I could wrap my mind around having the courage to actually make the journey. But I think, like Anthony, it's the biggest a-holes left in the world, or in the country rather, are in this one collection, and I would be found out immediately. I'd be the one like bumping in. I'm so sorry, excuse me. Or like, and then if you step on a kitten's head, you know, it's just, I couldn't pretend to be that kind of an a-hole long enough, I think, to fit in. And in terms of Tom, I do agree he's the perfect choice, but I really, really struggled, even, you know, with this last section, especially where we have the actual hypnosis and they're putting him into the journey. I was like, is this consent? I mean, is this actually consent here? Yeah. Is he able to give consent? And yeah. For me, the entrance of God, Tom, under hypnosis kind of answered that question for me. So I could let go of some of my very deep personal discomfort about what was happening. It's like, well, clearly this is God's will, you know, and it's not just Tom going. There's Tom we know, and there's Tom who is the higher spiritual Tom, and they'll both be on this journey, and hopefully he'll be protected, and maybe God himself is capable of giving this young man consent.
Mike, what did you think? Are you going? Are you volunteering yourself?
No, I'm a coward in that respect. I would be like, you could send me, or I could try to get the projector working at the movie theater. I think this section, it's a fascinating plot point to have to make the decision. And it made me very uncomfortable reading as it developed. And I think the things that helped, you know, very much, I completely agree with John Reeve about the consent issue for Tom. That was a big one. I think the three things that kind of made me grateful for the way he approached it were Franny's objections, which I think gave voice to the discomfort of the reader. And that was very important. I think the hypnosis and God's Tom, I think, helped enormously with making you feel like he wasn't just being sent purposelessly out into a place without any kind of safety net. It almost felt like even if he died, he was in good hands, and that was nice. And the thing that really cinched it for me was actually, I love the scene with Larry and the judge. I think the way it's approached and that he knows exactly why Larry's there, I think is really interesting. But what I loved the most was after that scene, that he'd kind of tempered his own actual excitement about having this role to play and about the importance of what he was going to do. And there's that lovely little, just a couple of pages of him taking off on the journey and feeling that invigoration that comes with real purpose. And that, I think, changed it up for me a little bit. That turned me around, because I was very uncomfortable, not only with it felt like, you know, these people are going to stick out like a Daily Show correspondent at a Trump rally when they get there. but that it was all part of some kind of bigger plan, not only on the part of the author, but, you know, something else in the story. So I liked it. But no, I would be useless in that. I'm way too much of a chicken shit.
Well,
I don't like Las Vegas. So.
Yeah.
There you go. If I could just jump on that for one second, too. I love the judge, because especially as an older person, and so I hear, as people age, they start to feel more obsolete, you know, and society definitely pushes you to the fringes, as we're seeing in our society. So I totally felt the judges' excitement at having a renewed sense of purpose despite the danger, you know, because we're all going to die some kind of way. But from his point of view, why not die doing something very important, you know, to help secure the future of mankind, which I could really relate to on a deep level, although I am still, for the record, a coward.
Well, and I'm already in Vegas, so you we've established that already in past episodes. I'm there, so you're
coming. And to be fair to Vegas, the only thing I hate about Vegas is gambling, because I'm terrible at it, because I have no poker face and I just lose my money. I actually love the restaurants and the shows and everything else about the city, but I would suck in Vegas. It would, yeah. I would just start smoking again. It would just be bad for everybody.
So I have a personal favorite moment in these five chapters, and I bet that if it's not echoing some of yours, I bet it's echoing at least some of the listeners. My personal favorite moment is the Planchette and Nadine's college flashback, just from a writing point of view. And I'll tell you why. It's because when that thing starts moving on its own, the tension and the dread and the fear that you start to feel reminds you suddenly, oh, right, this is a Stephen King novel. And there's a reason why Stephen King is the master of horror. And the way that those girls are written, it's what it really is a flashback to, is it ends up being like a flashback to Carrie, to like his first novel. There's even this line that says, what horrible thing could possibly happen in the middle of a gaggle of giggling girls. And it's like this wink that's like a smack upside the head from King that's saying, I'm still here and I'm still gonna get you. It is terrifying. It is one of the scariest moments in the book to me. And I was just like, ooh, horror. I'm like, horror, 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 horror. Like, I was just, I loved it.
He, I love it. If we could chat for a minute about Nadine, because he, I feel like, is brutal to that character in a way that I can't, I'm trying to think of another King character that he is as vicious toward as he is to Nadine, because she is exploited and defiled and just destroyed in a way that feels like she'd ever had any other fate that could have ever entered his mind as a writer. It was just that flashback scene to the Ouija board just makes it clear how kind of predetermined her fate is. And I find, when you say the horror, I think the horror that Nadine Cross experiences in this story is special compared to the horror that a lot of the other characters experience. It's that thing where it's like, I don't know if it's incredible horror writing or if he really like just did that character really dirty, but it's, you know, it's really rough. And by the end of this chapter with her and Harold, it was just, oh, it's so uncomfortably brutal the way he deals with her that, you know, yikes. And after the rejection by Mother Abigail, and to put her in a position where her perceived savior, like the only way out of this is to offer herself sexually to Larry. It just felt like this is a character who has no hope or options that aren't horribly exploitative. And it was a rough read, I thought, in a great way, because I think that's horror. But poor Nadine Cross, Jesus.
How proud are we of Larry too, when he you know, just says, I'm not gonna be like, because at the beginning of that, I thought Larry was really going to go down that road, and I thought he was going to go down that path. And it's almost like there's this, the way that it's described is, I think Lucy's there, and it's like Nadine's almost ignoring that she's there, and Larry starts ignoring that she's there, and there's this like like hypnotic thing. And I kept picturing there's a sequel to the 1931 Dracula with Bela Lugosi called Daughters of Dracula or Dracula's Daughter. And I just kept thinking about those, you know, those brides that are just, you know, so like hypnotic. And that I was like, man, he like broke the spell. I was very proud of him in that moment. But I agree with you. I agree with you, Mike. It's a brutal, brutal read what happens to Nadine.
It feels like if Nadine had been able to get to Larry or open up to Larry sooner, I felt more like he would have saved her more than she would have brought him down, which speaks to that sort of cruel position she's in. Because yes, this is a long fated position. So of course she's not going to be able to just walk away from that and embrace Larry like from jump and save herself. And it is a horrifying character to me in the sense that it replicates sometimes how the choices we make, and in this case there's a lot of fate, but she's also making some choices along the way. I mean, here she is, she rescued this kid that she worked with special needs children, you know, and she rescues this kid on the road and saves his life. She's not a bad person like some of the a-holes over there. She has this predestined thing on her back. And it really just feels like she comes so close. She comes so close to being salvation. And I had forgotten about that way that she was treated by Mother Abigail. So she didn't have a lifeline, you know, even from the highest level in the Free Zone, unfortunately, to help steer her in a better direction. So I hadn't thought, I guess I've sort of blocked out the fact that she's ended up with Harold, but I'm trying to block out everything you're doing. So I don't ruminate on that too long. But the rest of it to me just feels very, very sad. And I loathe Harold in a way that I do not loathe Nadine.
Very true. I mean, I think it's weird. I'm sorry, Anthony. Sorry.
Oh, go ahead. You go ahead.
I just think it's weird that you've got characters in Flag that are like the anti-Christ, and you look at Nadine and she's the anti-Virgin Mary. Kind of this twisted Mary story with the same, you know, the Ouija board's the visitation of the angel, and you know,
the same sort of predestination almost.
Yeah.
The same sort of doesn't have a choice almost. It sort of felt like
yeah.
Mike, you could be a Sunday school teacher.
I would be the atheist Sunday school teacher.
Yeah, but you know it though.
Sometimes atheists are some of the most spiritually minded people I've ever met in my life. So you never know. You never know.
Well, I wonder, I'm trying to remember now if it's in the text, but you're right that nobody extends the hand to Nadine, even the way they do to Harold, the way they literally do to Harold, when Stu shakes his hand and tells him, you know, thanks for all you're doing. And then they come up with that nickname Hawk for him that makes him feel like, maybe I do belong here.
Yeah.
I wonder if it was Mother Abigail's job to offer that little bit of hope to Nadine, and by turning off and pushing her away, if that's one of the failures that Mother Abigail perceives. I don't know if it's mentioned directly, but like you could see that as a point of pride that she took, that she was not willing to help coax this woman over the line to the light side, and in doing so, walled her off. Shut her out. Because I do think Nadine is yearning for somebody to just offer that option, right? We joke about it we talk about it with Trump supporters, right? Is how do you convince, if somebody converts or changes their mind, you shouldn't chase them away for the bad decision they made. You should welcome their change of heart or their change of perspective, right? Or theoretically, but for some people you can't do that. And I wonder if that's something that's happened here. If somebody had given her a shot, maybe things would have turned out differently. But instead, even Mother Abigail said, nope.
And even in that moment, when Nadine walks away, when she walks back from Mother Abigail, Larry says, why did you act like that? What did you do? And it was, she really hadn't done anything. It was more a reaction to Mother Abigail's sort of immediate, I know who you are, or what have you. And it also, it ties in with everything everyone is saying, that there's never an opportunity for her to kind of end up on the side of the angels at all.
Yeah, it's interesting. The more that I think about it, the more that it almost seems, it seems like its own sort of predestined thing. It's really interesting. It's definitely an uncomfortable read, though, in a good way. I mean, I read horror because I want to be uncomfortable. So I've really enjoyed everything that I've read of the interactions that she's had, both before getting to this place, like the flashback and this. It's definitely like something's been following her. Like there's this dark cloud that's been over her from the beginning, which is definitely interesting to see. And I've only read The Stand once, and I only read the 70s version. This is my first time reading the complete uncut version. So I don't really remember a lot of the end. I don't remember really where she goes from here. So I'm very excited to find out in the coming chapters. There's one more thing that I wanted to bring up, and this might be a bit of a stretch, but I always try to mention when I see a link or a correlation to another King novel. And there's this brief moment that feels to me like it might be either consciously or subconsciously, again, I could be reaching, a connection to The Shining. And it's in Kojak's return. Kojak's return is just one of the most heartwarming, amazing moments in the in these chapters. And in his own flashback, he's talking about what he went through with the wolves and the attack of the wolves on him and that sort of thing. And, you know, I don't know if you remember or not, or how many people have read The Shining here, but I imagine Mike probably maybe has once or twice. The word wasps is used 71 times in The Shining. And wasps are actually, it becomes almost like a representation of Jack's anger, that when he's angry, that he hears the wasps and everything. And so there's this weird moment where in Kojak's flashback to being attacked by these wolves, Kojak's inner dialogue is, wasps in me, oh the wasps in my head, wasps are up in my head, wasps. And I'm like, where's this wasp thing coming from? And I'm like, where have I heard that before? And I was like, oh, The Shining. So I don't know if I'm reaching there or if it's just a bizarre coincidence that Kojak is thinking about wasps. Ideas, thoughts, comments?
Maybe. I mean, it sounds like it's definitely speaks to how King views the experience of anger.
Yes.
Because, yeah, and the empty wasp nest in The Shining that becomes suddenly repopulated with wasps even after they're all killed is a big, big moment to kind of say that, you know, Jack's internal anger and violence can't be snuffed away, even if all evidence, you know, to the contrary is presented. So he also uses them in The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon in a similar way, where
I haven't read that yet.
Yeah, and that comes down to this elemental spirit in the woods that's embodied. It looks like a bear sometimes, but other times, no, not so much. And there's talk of the noise it makes being like wasps. And I might be remembering this wrong. I feel like wasps come out of its mouth at one point. Or that might be a gag from The Simpsons where he says the dogs, when they bark, the bees and bees. Yeah, it's something. Who knows? But I think it's an interesting thing, given, you know, that the Stand and The Shining aren't that far apart from each other chronologically in his life when he sat to write them, and if he was still at a point in his own experience where he identified so much with Jack and had that sense of those wasps inside, that he would recontextualize them into a survival instinct instead of a abuse instinct, I think is pretty interesting. But I think that's a really cool catch.
Awesome. Well, listen, I adore you all so much. I really do. I'm so sorry to our listeners that we took a bit of a hiatus there, but I think we're back on track. And I think we all have really crazy schedules, and it's hard to find an exact moment when it just meets up with all of us. But we're going to do our best to make sure that we can continue to do that every month. And it's like being with old friends every time I'm with you guys. Just thank you so much for doing this and for being here. And thank you, Andy, also for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
Listen, next month we're going to be discussing chapters 56 through 70. You can get notified when new episodes go live by subscribing at thestandpodcast.com. And you'll also find links to bonus podcast episodes, to Nonary Dew's online course, Anthony's first look at CBS's The Stand for Vanity Fair, and so much more. And as we close today's episode, The Stand Podcast asks you to take a stand, whether it is to the EMS FDNY Help Fund, which you can find links to on thestandpodcast.com, or to the charity of your choice. Please find a way to make your stand on the side of the good and donate whatever you can to help those who are suffering from COVID-19 in the middle of this pandemic, because you know what? It ain't over, man. People are still getting sick, and some of those people are the ones who are on the front lines, putting their lives on the line to help others every day. The EMS FDNY Help Fund looks to support those very individuals. Go to thestandpodcast.com, scroll down, and make a donation today. And until next time, remember, the place where you make your stand doesn't matter. Only that you do, and that you're still on your feet.